Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 153 on selecting the best passive multifamily real estate investments with Travis Watts. Travis is affiliated with the Ashcroft Capital team you'd probably recognize as Joe Fairless's company, as he's been on the show here a few times and I've been on Joe Fairless's show. Travis shares a unique perspective here, one that I believe many of us real estate investors aspire to, of being totally passive in his real estate investing. Travis decided a few years ago to liquidate all of his real estate investments, all of the active real estate investments, and begin placing that capital to work in multifamily deals run by other operators. While it's hands-off, of course, Travis pays attention to the numbers, the economy, and the business in general, but that would be prudent and wise with any investment, whether it's a single-family rental house, a $100 million multifamily syndication deal, running your own business, or even something so passive as an investment in a company like Amazon. Let's get started. All right, Mr. Travis Watts, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
Hey, doing well. Thanks so much for having me, Dan. Appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. And for context, we got a lot going on, and I think time stamping our episodes has been something important recently. So we're actually doing this one on March 24th, 2020. And I'm sure in a week or so when this episode is released, there'll be all kinds of new information that probably makes what we're going to touch on at some point today a little bit outdated. But yeah, for context, I am in the condo recording here in Chicago under lockdown. Whereabouts are you recording from, and what's your situation there, Travis?
Yeah, so I'm also in our condo downtown Denver, locked down as well. I think our mandatory lockdown starts today, in fact, at 5 p.m.
Gotcha. Yeah, interesting times. It is what it is. I'm sure we'll touch on that in a moment. But before we do, for anyone who may not know your name and what you've been up to, maybe the Reader's Digest version about kind of what you did in your career that led up to, you know, the real estate and your business, what it looks like today.
Sure, yeah. Excuse me. So my background starts like probably a lot of your listeners or a lot of folks in real estate in that I got started with single family homes. I just felt like that was the only way to become a real estate investor, at least the best starting point at that time. So as I got going with it, I did everything from house hacking and renting spare bedrooms to fix and flips to vacation rentals to having some buy and hold properties, and eventually just basically burned myself out in the process. It was a tremendous learning curve. I started out in 2009, just after the recession, and about 5 years in, started realizing that's really difficult to scale. It's really difficult to have, you know, say 50 or 100 single family homes that either you self manage or that you're having property managers manage for you. So I had to kind of go back to the drawing board, figure out what I was really after and what my goals were really about and why. And at that point, I made a really big transition into being a full-time passive real estate investor. I wanted to be completely out of the active business and just using real estate as an asset class to invest in so that I could focus on other things. And, you know, other things are different for everybody. And for some people, it's their career or their business or their family or travel. And so that shift was about 2015. And so ever since 2015, I'm a full-time limited partner, passive investor, basically, in apartment syndications. And that leads us up to your through today.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that's it's funny as you're talking about the frustration and the inability to scale. I'm looking at my business and we did 223 single family. We bought them. Some of them we did a full renovation. Some of them we just bought them and sold them. but we closed 223 deals, and the profit was over $5 million, but it was split between, you know, 14 or 15 different partners in three markets. And I think we're at like 40 closings year to date, bought, sold, renovated, whatever. So we've kind of scaled it a little bit, and we do well in the single family space. We're blessed to have a really good team, but, yeah, it's a lot of paperwork and a lot of people with a lot of effort and a lot of activity to make all that take place. And, you talk about reevaluating and then, you know, repositioning yourself as a full-time passive investor. I think maybe you should define that. So is it kind of like a place in a career where someone probably has made a pretty decent nest egg to then transfer over to being a full-time passive investor? Because, like, I'll look at my rental portfolio of 25 units or something like that, and I'm like, man, this is not passive at all. I'm constantly wiring money for repairs. I'm okaying things via email. Like, it's pretty active for me to even manage my property manager who's managing those units. So would you mind kind of putting a frame around what you would consider as a full-time passive investor?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, that's a hell of success in your world. So congratulations on that. I came from a completely different standpoint and mindset and model in that the part that I left out in that story I shared is that simultaneously I was working an oil field job that was about 98 hours per week, and a lot of times that was away from home. And at the tail end of that career, it was, in fact, in the Middle East, overseas. So I was completely out of pocket. And so kind of when you're trying to balance these two things, from scaling a single-family portfolio that I mostly managed myself on top of that career specifically, it was a burnout scenario for me. So yes, and again, just to repaint that picture, it's certainly possible, and for a lot of folks, a great model in the single family space. For those with a heavy career focus or maybe just a heavy emphasis elsewhere, I think the passive model could make a lot of sense. So to answer your last question here, so this is what happened for me. I didn't learn until a couple of years ago about something called the FIRE movement, Financial Independence Retire Early. It's an acronym, FIRE, which essentially, it's not a huge movement, by the way, but it's a bunch of folks out there who typically have high incomes, but they're living well below their means, and they're taking that margin, kind of that excess in the middle, and putting that into investments so that they can maybe sustain that high-paying job that they don't necessarily enjoy too much for a period of time, and then kind of take off early in the working career to pursue other avenues, or maybe switch to part-time or consulting and things like that. So I kind of followed that model. So I was doing a job I didn't necessarily like, I didn't necessarily fit into, and I was living well below my means, and I was house hacking and renting spare bedrooms out, so I had very little overhead. I had no kids, and, you know, that's just sort of what I was doing, and I was throwing all of that spare money towards real estate and, of course, making money in real estate as well with single-family homes, to the point where one day I sat down, I think it was just a simple Excel sheet, and I started mapping out my equity and where all that equity was held. And basically my epiphany, my breakthrough moment, was to consider, if I sold everything, if I sold the house I lived in, all of my rentals, if I went pure liquid in cash, and then I came back with syndications or apartment investing with a conservative cash flow in mind, what would that mean for me? And what it actually ended up meaning for me was I could leave that job. And to me at the time, that meant the most to me. I didn't necessarily have a plan other than I hate this job and I can't do this forever. And, you know, why not now? So that's kind of where I had my breakthrough is at that moment.
So you mentioned the conservative cash flow, and I know you're plugged in with some big players, and you've been a party, which I'm sure we're going to touch on, in some pretty decent sized syndications and things of that nature. So you're like an, I would consider just knowing a little bit of your background an insider when it comes to selecting syndication apartment multifamily deals, which I think we've had a lot of people on the show here. And if people have looked out, reached out, you know, touch base, they're probably also similarly connected. But in your opinion or your experience, rather, what would be a conservative cash flow rate of return? So if someone had $1 million in equity in your similar situation, they were going to sell all of that equity off and put it into syndications, what would be a reasonable rate of return that they would expect, look for, reasonably find in the marketplace now or even a few weeks ago? I know things are changing dramatically here currently, but what would that number look like?
Yeah, that number for me back when, 2015, was around 8% a year in terms of cash flow distributions. And that's always my first focus. Since I decided to make this a full-time venture and since I decided cash flow will now become my income, all of the projects out there that I look at have to be, you know, cash flowing out of the gate, and more specifically, if possible, ideally, monthly distributions and monthly income. So back then, I would say 8% was conservative. Got into a few deals that were slightly higher than that, none that were lower than that at the time. And now as we move forward to 2020, despite recent happenings in our economy, if we just back up a few months, I would say that number has probably changed slightly down. I would say maybe 6 to 7% annually for cash flow. But you know, just to keep in mind for your listeners or anyone unfamiliar with syndication, it's kind of a twofold type of play. Half of your half of the income comes out of cash flow and collected rents and things like that. These are just loose numbers, by the way. It's not always half. And then the other half kind of comes on the back end upon sale. Hopefully that equity is there if you're doing kind of a value add or a fixing up of a property. So point being, when I decided to make this my income, I wasn't even factoring in any of the equity on the backside. I was just basically saying, if it's there, that's great. If it's not, oh well, and I'm looking at cash flow. So on your $1 million example, for me that would have equated to, you know, $80,000 a year in income with $1 million invested. And then in today's climate, minus the COVID and all that kind of stuff, you know, maybe $60,000, $70,000, somewhere in that range.
Do you think that expected cash flow return, do you think we're talking about coming out of this COVID thing and none of us has a crystal ball, but do you think that you're going to look for, you know, 7, 8, 9%, or do you think 6 and 7 is still a deal that you would personally invest in a month from now, this week, assuming that it all blows over? I mean, where do you think we are real time right now in the midst of the COVID thing from an investor's perspective with a lot of experience?
Yeah, I think that a lot of sponsors and general partners putting these deals together are a bit on pause. You know, it's hard to look at, say, a T12, a trailing 12 statement, and make sense of it in today's environment. Rents may have been paid the last 12 months at a 95% occupancy, but what does that mean if you're looking at that today? That really means nothing, because we don't know what April and May and June are going to look like. So I think just everyone's kind of pumping the brakes a bit. There's obviously still some deals being sent back and forth that are coming across my desk, but again, it's hard to put that in perspective without knowing exactly kind of what the next few months are going to look like. You know, I don't anticipate personally any catastrophic or major impact to, you know, affordable housing and the multifamily sector overall. I do think we're going to struggle through the next few months, depending on what kind of stimulus is put out there and depending on how our tenants are going to react and, you know, who's going to be moving or not moving and who's going to be paying and not paying. And, you know, it's yet to be determined. We're kind of right on that brink coming up here towards April 1st, and that'll be a sure tell sign by the end of June, kind of what's going on. So we'll have to see. I wish my crystal ball could tell me.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I mean, I'm personally with the 20 some odd units. To me, that was just kind of my savings account. You know, I got that little bits of equity there, and I've got a little bit of cash flow there, and it's nothing I could, like, retire on. I've collected my portfolio, personal portfolio, no syndications, no outside leverage. It was just, like, places for the money that I was saving to go into as I saw certain deals come across that I liked at the time. But I'm, you know, kind of checking myself right now. And I personally, you know, I built a business in the single family space, like I had mentioned earlier in the episode, and the listeners already know. And I intentionally focused on the single family and did more of that along the way when I had come to the crossroads of, hey, do I keep going straight on this path and dig down and go deeper with diamond equity investments in the single family space? Or do I, you know, transition and take the other fork in the road to go with the scaled up multifamily, start syndicating deals and buying 10 and 20 and 30 million and on up properties. I chose the way that I'm on now because, to be quite frank, I was always a little bit hesitant and scared because I didn't have enough reserves to, like, maybe cover the mortgage payment on an 8, 10, 20 million dollar mortgage if some large percentage of the tenants didn't pay the rent. I guess there's probably a case, I'm sure, the syndicators cover for things of this nature and raise extra capital in the event they had to make two or three or five mortgage payments on a much larger mortgage that, like, I'm sitting here facing right now, Travis. It's like, okay, on the mortgages that I have on these 20 some units, I am in a position to cover those mortgages for, you know, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, even if no tenants paid any money at all, I'd be okay and I'm going to meet my obligations to the bank. I mean, that said, are the syndications that you've seen, participated, and invested in, heard of, that are already in play and moving, you know, the multifamily deals that you're aware of, are there reserves? And if you had to guess, how many months of reserves would there be if it was a 20 or a 30% drop off in collection rate for the rent?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And so this is where it kind of gets back to, if you're going to do what I do, any of your listeners, be a limited partner where, you know, you have limited say in what's going on the deal, it really at the end of the day comes down to the team that you're working with and how conservative is that team being and what kind of CapEx reserves are they saving for and what decisions are they going to make as far as distributions during a time like today versus withholding distributions for the what if possibilities. And so, yes, I mean, every sponsor, general partner putting a deal together should have adequate cash reserves for all kinds of unplanned uncertainty. We never really know what's going to come up as far as a tornado, a hurricane, a flood, a fire, you know, something massive in that local area that dips our occupancy down 20%. There could be all kinds of things. And so there needs to be those adequate reserves on hand. Now, what we're seeing, again, you mentioned this and kind of gave this disclaimer earlier, but, you know, Fannie and Freddie just came out to say they're basically going to have some forbearance relief. You know, if you have Fannie and Freddie loans in the multifamily sector, meaning that mortgage payments, you know, might be able to be deferred for a little while till we figure out what's going on and how we're going to handle it. Now, you can't ever count on that stuff. And who knows, you know, how that's really going to work logistically. But a lot of the larger multifamily has Fannie and Freddie agency debt on them. So yeah, I mean, we're completely in uncharted territory and it is scary. And you do think a lot about worst case scenarios. And so a good syndicate group is going to do like a sensitivity analysis. Some people call this a stress test. And on every deal, you know, that I'm doing, the groups have this to show to their investors before you take part in the deal. And what this sensitivity test will show you is, what happens if interest rates go from 3% to 6%? What happens if our occupancy goes from our projected 90% level to 60%? What's our break-even occupancy? And I think all this stuff is very important to pay attention to, even in great economies, in great markets. And that kind of gives you a slight indication of what could happen. Okay. And a lot of the multifamily I'm invested in has a break even occupancy of somewhere around 60%. So you can kind of put that in proportion if we're talking about 100 unit or 200 unit or 300 unit. That, you know, to me, those are great numbers. You can lose an awful lot of tenants and still be able to meet your operating expenses and your debt service is what that's really indicating.
Nice. And do you have a preferred? I know you were involved with, I think, Ashcroft Capital. Do you have like a particular, you know, team that's exclusively doing and operating all of your investments, or do you, invest in this team and this team and this team? I mean, what's your level of exclusivity with the partnerships that you've invested in?
Yeah, I'll take a minute and just kind of paint that picture. So I am part of the Ashcroft Capital team, and kind of going back to when I left the oil field, not really having a plan, but just knowing this is going to give me the ability, this passive income is going to give me the ability to pursue meaningful work to me, things that I'm actually interested in, that I want to grow with, that I want to know more about. Well, that led to working with, you know, Ashcroft Capital, for example. So, you know, leading up through this crazy time that we're in today, I was doing a lot of live events with them. That's something I've always done for my own self-education, is attend live summits and seminars and conferences. And so, you know, historically, you probably would have seen me, you know, at the Ashcroft Capital booth, just helping answer people's questions as part of the investor relations team. So that being said, why Ashcroft, just as an example? Well, they were a group I found about 4 years ago. I started investing with as a limited partner, and I've invested in 9 of their deals, and that equates to about 30% of my overall portfolio. And it's just because the alignment of interest. I sat down with my wife. We weren't married at the time, but my girlfriend, and kind of as I was making this dedication to be passive in my approach, we started kind of putting down criteria. What was most important to us in criteria if we were going to take this path? And it was things like, you know, Texas and Florida and monthly distributions and value add plans and B and C class multifamily. And we just had this huge list. And Ashcroft was just one of those groups that literally checked all of our boxes for us. And so that's why we've continued investing with them. It's just a great model. But that being said, you know, I've invested with 14 different syndication groups in the space. So it's not just exclusive to one, and, you know, they're not the only shop in town, just a great group that I'm happy to affiliate with and help answer questions for folks about them.
Nice. So you mentioned sitting down, thinking through this process. This doesn't sound like a knee jerk. Okay, I'm going to get out of the oil job and I'm going to blow out all my properties or do whatever you had to do there. You sounds like you sat down, formulated the plan, figured out, you know, what was the asset class that looked like. Cause a lot of people say, like, oh, multifamily, I'm going to do the investor in syndications. But there's a lot of different avenues there. You've got, you know, the value add where you're buying 40-50% economic occupancy or even just physical occupancy type of projects that are high risk and hopefully high return. You've got, you know, investing in A-class assets, which might be, you know, REIT, publicly traded, securities on Wall Street that are in A-class properties. And then you've got your B and C or your repositioning strategies. I'm sure there's, you know, 10, 20 different niches that you could go into. And I like how you sat down and you really thought through the investment philosophy before you made the jump. Can you touch on what the actual process of making the jump looked like? Like, you had other properties. Did you actually sell them all? Did you refinance them all? If someone's listening in right now, Travis, I'm trying to paint a picture of, like, what did it look like for you to make a transition from that single family space where, like, if I got, let's say, my 20 some odd units, if I was going to make the same progression, you know, what might that look like for me? And what did that look like for you as you shifted?
Yeah, great. So you pointed out a great point, and that's that, you know, don't make a knee jerk reaction. That'd be the worst thing that you could do. And have solid fundamental reasons for, you know, whatever it is you want to do, whether that's single family, multifamily, A, B, C, D. Just understand the risks, the rewards, and why you're doing those things. And so, you know, this has been an evolution for me. And when I actually made this decision, it wasn't fully made in my head at the time when I thought I'm going to do syndications. It was just a just kind of more theoretical, I guess, at the point. And so I did my research. I talked to quite a few people who had been doing this for a number of years. And then I started with just one deal. I sold one of my properties, which I was selling anyway for different reasons. And I took that a portion of that equity, and I just did the minimum investment. And I just went with a local group that I had met up with face-to-face in my own city. And I just did one deal, and I'm not very good at being patient, by the way. And it took a tremendous amount of patience because I wanted to sit back and make sure this was the real deal. And, you know, to be frank with you, I was skeptical. I thought this is too good to be true. These returns are impossible. These returns are projected to be higher than what I'm actually making on my active single family portfolio that I'm having to put a lot of work into. So I didn't believe that this could be done. But it started unfolding month by month, you know, and so then I did the second deal, and then I did a third deal, and then I was selling another property. And so this took about, you know, a year to a year and a half, somewhere in that wheelhouse, before I really kind of went full into this. So patience is key. And I'm so glad that I was patient, because I would have been tempted, if I just had, you know, $1 million equity just up front in cash, I would have been tempted to put it all into two or three deals and be done just to get that money working for me. And that would have ended up being a mistake by the groups that I knew at the time. I've learned to find there's a lot of great groups out there, but they weren't the folks I started with.
Gotcha. And does that mean that, I mean, that you've done 14 plus 9, I'm taking some notes here, probably more than that, but did any of them go bad? And if so, how do you deal with those that don't work out as you thought, if you wouldn't mind talking about maybe someone else can avoid that mistake?
Yeah. So the thing that I point out that was probably my biggest mistake was working with a team based off the pro forma or the anticipated returns without factoring who's behind the scenes, who's actually executing this business plan, and what's their track record and what's their experience, and, you know, what kind of connections do they have, and have they done this before, and is what they're doing today consistent with past projects that they've taken on? And there's so much, like I alluded to earlier on our call, it's so much about the team. I mean, you are placing your money with a team, and you're saying that team is going to be making decisions on my behalf in my best interest. So forget about the deal for a minute. Number one is the team. Number two, I would argue, is the market. And then number three is the deal. If you've got the first two in place, you know, your risk goes way down and your likelihood of success goes way up. And so in my experience of deals gone bad, it wasn't necessarily the deal that went bad. We actually bought a good deal in the right market at the right price. And as the operators started implementing the business plan and then realized that's a lot of work and they weren't really good at it and they couldn't actually do it, they just failed, basically, and they sold the project as is. So something I went into thinking, oh, this is going to be a 5 to 7 year hold, I'm going to get 10% of your cash flow, all these kinds of things, ended up being an 18-month turnaround where distributions had been cut off and they just went to sell it because they didn't know what else to do with it. And so I actually ended up profitable, thankfully, in those types of scenarios in the beginning. But it was a huge disappointment, and it taught me to focus so much more on the team and forget about the deal.
Yeah, it's really a blessing for me, Travis, to have a chance to host these, you know, the REI Diamond Show, these podcast conversations like we're having right now. And I realize that, you know, yeah, I'm running a business with the help of my partners in the single family space, and we're doing some cool stuff. But when you describe getting out of a deal in 18 months and, you know, the 5 to 7 year hold period, I'm realizing as we speak that I think part of the reason I didn't take that road into multifamily was that I don't like the idea of the 5 to 7 year management period. Let's say if I were the Ashcroft Capital team, it's a little bit of a longer term mindset. And like, I do a lot of things. I feel like I think on a long term, but I don't like the idea of a deal for me that I'm responsible for lasting 5 to 7 or 5 to 10 years. I'm fine with it if these are the houses that I personally own and I don't owe anybody answers, but I do feel it deep in my soul. I feel a humongous responsibility to anybody whose money that I have been entrusted with. So people obviously invest in our deals, our single family deals. And I love the fact that for us, it's like a 6 month, 12 month, you know, if it's a really tough project and the market got messed up and, you know, the project didn't go, we've owned for a little longer than 12 months on certain ones. But mm-hmm. it's a nice short hold window. So I feel like, I feel like there's this end date for me when I flip a house and it's, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, whatever. It's a year out versus 5 to 7 years out. I'm like, wow, I'm not as patient of an investor that maybe you are to want to be in a deal for 5, 6, 7, or 10 years, just kind of a personal revelation. But it's cool because I can see my shortcoming. And then, you know, in times like now where I have a little bit of money into some securities on Wall Street, which are way, way, way down, if anyone's paying attention to the market right now, it's like, okay, you know what? I'm going to have to exercise some of Travis's patience here on this one. And then just kind of weather the storm, as I think we're all actually doing right now. Everyone in the entire United States and around the world is practicing patience as we're all stuck at home, unable to go out and, you know, not able to exercise the freedoms that most of us are able to enjoy every other time of the year. At what point would you say the patience kind of grew for you and became a little bit more comfortable? Has it come with age? Is it something you intentionally developed?
I think for me, being that I made a decision that cash flow was going to be my income, I prefer not to have interruptions in my income. So I'm more apt to do a five-year deal. I've certainly invested with groups that have more of like a, I guess you could deem it like an infinite return model. So they don't actually project to ever sell. So I could be in some of those deals for who knows how long, 20 years, I don't know. But, you know, but I limit my exposure to those two because things change in life. And if I completely change my philosophy in 15 years, I don't want to be, you know, in a lot of that stuff that I can't get out of. So I think the sweet spot in the syndication space is this five-year period, because a lot of people want to keep that capital fresh, you know. So even though 5 years may seem like a really long time frame in terms of what you're currently doing, it's actually the short time frame in terms of, you know, long-term hold real estate. And it's that sweet spot, because when a syndicator is raising funds and capital to do a deal, they're raising enough to basically get them through a five-year period to renew and refresh the whole project, replace hot water tanks and HVAC systems and all these kinds of things, roof repairs. Well, what happens is then you run out of that CapEx budget minus the reserves for the what-if unexpected stuff in that five-year time frame. And if you keep holding, that means in 10 years you start to need new HVAC systems again, new hot water tanks again, a new roof replacement again. And where is that money going to come from? So you're going to have to either stop distributions to collect money to pay for those items, or you're going to have to do like a capital call where you're calling your investors up saying, we need you to put more money in the project because we got more repairs and maintenance to do, you know, things like that. So nobody wants to do that kind of thing. You could also refinance theoretically and pull some equity out and then cover those expenses, but that's just pulling out of your own distributions anyway. So the sweet spot happens to be that five-year time frame. In the deals I've invested in, realistically, deals end up selling more along the three-year mark. But again, being a limited partner, it's something to look inward and be comfortable with, that you're not making the shots. You're not going to decide. You might be in it for 18 months like I was, or you might be in it for 7 years when it was supposed to be five. That's out of your discretion in most cases. So just be comfortable with that. But back to your point, I like that time frame because I'll do 2 weeks of my due diligence on a deal before I invest, where I'm talking to the team, I'm visiting the property, I'm going through everything I can do and backgrounds and all this kind of stuff. So I do the work up front, but now I can set and forget for approximately 5 years, and I don't have to worry about the interruptions that may come from that, theoretically, and versus, you know, every 6 to 12 months something's turning over, and that becomes more active again because I've got 27 deals circulating and, you know, two or three are coming due every few months, and I'm having to reallocate the capital. It becomes more of an active business, and so it's personal. There's nothing wrong with either approach. That's just kind of why I prefer the longer-term approach.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So let's go back to our $1 million in equity or $1 million in cash example at, you know, 6, 7, 8% return. So let's go with 8%. I want you to just kind of guess for me. We take our million, we're making $80,000 a year, but there's depreciation that's involved typically that's going to the partners. So like 8% return plus, you know, some depreciation tax benefits probably offsets that. Is that almost like somebody actively working for $100,000 a year? Is it maybe a little more? I mean, have you had some tax benefits where you're like, wow, here's a whole nother powerful angle that I didn't realize until I started filing some tax returns? Because I know I've had those moments already, even with my 20-something properties where the depreciation was like an extra raise come tax time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you hit the nail on the head. I didn't get into this business or this game or real estate at all for tax benefits, but as it turns out, that's a huge, huge component and a huge factor, especially for folks that can qualify as an active real estate professional and things like this, which you have to get with your CPA on that. I'm not a tax advisor, but you know, there's the ability in some people's situations to basically take depreciation or passive losses and then offset active income from other sources, whether it be 1099, W-2, things like that. So, again, I'm not advocating that, you know, that everybody qualifies for that, so check with your CPA. But, yes, to answer your question, it can be similar to what you described when you talk about, oh, $80,000 a year. Well, if you put it in terms of working for an employer and paying Social Security and Medicare and, you know, all these deductions that get taken out and plus your tax brackets, then that could be the equivalent for, you know, $110,000 per year in some cases. And so you do have to weigh that in. And there's so much depreciation loss from cost segregation and bonus depreciation that comes through on your K-1 tax form. That's what you get when you're a limited partner in a syndication. You get one tax form already filled in for you. There's nothing you have to do. And just to give a simple example, if you invested $100,000 into a deal, you might receive a K-1 tax form the following year that says you lost on paper a negative like $40,000. And so what that's meaning is all the distributions that have been sent to you, let's just say that was $8,000 that got sent to you that previous year, not only is that offset by that depreciation, meaning you're not paying any tax on that $8,000 that you received, you're able to take that excess loss and apply it towards other income and interest and dividends, distributions, things like that. So it can be a really huge thing. It's just hard to talk about being a non-professional in the space. All I can say to that is find a competent, experienced CPA or tax professional that specializes in what you do. And that goes for anything and everything. When I worked in the oil field overseas, I was using the same CPA I had used for years and years and years before doing that business. And I was paying federal tax, state tax, like everybody else. Well, turns out, was actually exempt from a lot of that income because it was being made overseas. So I had to switch CPA firms for them to be able to explain that to me and how legally, I wasn't supposed to be paying those taxes. So we had to go back and amend like 3 years of tax returns. It was a pain in the butt, but it put a lot of money back in my pocket. And it really just, I learned that lesson the hard way. You've just got to find tax professionals doing what you do or understanding fully what you do.
Yeah, it's ironic. I mean, I am an advocate for the tax pros. I am also an advocate for asking around and doing the research and kind of digging into the IRS codes sometimes on my own. I mean, there's a ton of info available online. And so it's like, hey, do I understand this thing enough? I feel like a little bit, you know, it's kind of like, and I'm not a CPA and I'm not trying to give tax advice. I'm not a doctor and I'm not trying to give medical advice, but like, I try to take the approach of being curious about how it works so that I'm asking the right questions, doing a little bit of research, you know, on my own, maybe a lot of research on my own, so that when I go, you know, to the doctor, I'm kind of like having the right questions to ask, I hope. And when I'm going to my tax guy, I'm trying to bring up our my business is complicated and complex in how the taxes are done. It's not nice, simple 1K1 kind of a thing. And I have to take responsibility for setting that up. And it was like kind of a revelation when I grew up of like, oh, no one's going to do this totally for me. Like no one took you aside and told you like, oh, you've been paying too much tax for the last 3 years. You kind of had to like ask the questions and discover that fact on your own. So yeah, I think taking responsibility is definitely a good position there. So Travis, are there any books that you've maybe like recommended, have been recommended to you? Doesn't have to be real estate related, but along the way that were like really impactful for helping to develop your mindset or the results that you get in life today?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Well, just right there on the topic of taxes, I read Tax-Free Wealth. That's written by Tom Wheelwright, CPA and real estate investor. And, oh my gosh, that book, you know, if I had read that book way back when, it wouldn't have meant a thing to me, honestly. I just would have thrown it in the trash because none of it applied. It's all about real estate and small business and, you know, large business as well. And all the advantages that are available to you, all the tax advantages available to you and all the different things you can invest in and all the ways you can run your business. And just that little book, you know, that $20 book, I don't even know the numbers, probably saved me $30,000 plus in taxes at least, maybe more, just from reading that book. And so, yeah, I mean, it's huge. So you read something like that, you take some notes, and like you said, Dan, you take that to your tax person and say, hey, look, you know, I was reading this book, and here's kind of what they outlined, and, you know, I'd like to do that. You know, does that apply to my situation? And that's kind of how it works. So I'm not going to go study, you know, the tax code book of thousands of pages, but I am going to take an expert's advice on certain things, you know, and try to figure out how to apply that to my situation. So Tax-Free Wealth, Tom Wheelwright. Oh, gosh, I mentioned the FIRE movement. It's, you know, the cool thing is whether or not you subscribe to that whole philosophy, there's a lot of great components to FIRE, such as just in general, you know, having enough savings put aside for these what-if conditions like the ones that we're in today and, you know, diversifying and knowing your budget and where your money goes month to month and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's a great book called Choose FI for Financial Independence. And this is more like practical how-to strategies, like very specifically, like how to pay off student loan debt quickly, how to house hack and live for free and all these like little things. And not all of it may apply to you, but you may pull two or three things out of there that could save you a ton of money and time. And then what's the other one? Tony Robbins, been a huge fan of Tony. We're supposed to be there actually this month out in California. Of course, they canceled the event, but my wife and I were heading out there. So always read Tony Robbins, you know, kind of a motivational life coach, studies human psychology and what makes us do what we do and how do we make decisions and how to break bad habits and all that kind of stuff. So mindset and goals, great book of his is Unleash the Power Within. I read that way back when, and I continue reading that book about every 3 to 4 years or when fundamental things change in my life. And it's always something new to take away from that. So those would be the three, I guess, I'd point out.
Nice. So if you could, I know we did a lot of, I wish we would have known this at the beginning, but I don't know, 18, 19, 20 years old, however old you were when you started with real estate investing or maybe even before that, what would be the crown jewel of wisdom, knowing everything you know now, that you would go back and tell yourself then, if you could?
Yeah, it's really interesting because as we get older and we become different versions of ourselves, you forget what mindsets were like when you were 18. And it would be easy to say, oh, talk about passive income and multifamily and depreciation. But the fact is, I've got a nephew who's 18 right now. And when I tell him some of this stuff, it's just so far above his head that he doesn't care. And then I got to thinking, I probably wouldn't have either. And so here's what I would say to everybody, no matter what your age, but specifically to me at 18, starting with your goals and your why, you know, and that's in relation to anything in life, you know, starting with why do you really want that, or is that really what you want, and setting up goals, you know, to get there. And they can be abstract. They can be high level stuff. I want to travel the world one day, or I want to whatever it is. They don't have to be that detailed. But the thing is, you need motivation, right? You need a purpose. And I hear too many people when I ask them about like their real estate goals, they'll just give an arbitrary answer like, well, I just want some extra money. I just want, you know, $10,000 a month cash flow. And you say, okay, well, why do you want $10,000 a month cash flow? Well, I don't know. It's just the number people throw out all the time. So I think spending a little more time on the why in the purpose is going to get you a whole lot further and give you a reason to drive forward when you run into some roadblocks and hurdles and things like that.
Well said. Well said. Yeah, I agree. My daughter's 18 right now, and she's hopefully heading off to college in the fall. They canceled the rest of her senior year, but she could care less about real estate. She could care less about what I'm up to, what I'm doing, and if I try to sit her down. I think I brought Rich Dad, Poor Dad in there, like my dad did when I was 17. And I think I read it when I was 18 or 19. I remember reading it when I was like 25, 26, and then that's when I got into real estate. But what a great observation that the 18-year-old self probably wouldn't have cared what I had to say now at 39 years old myself. So gotta love it.
Couldn't agree more. I was about that age too. I was somewhere around 18 when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So that's interesting. So
nice. Cool. So, Travis, if anyone wants to get some more information about you, do you have something that people could go, website, anything of that nature to contact you?
Yeah, so I've got a free passive investor resource guide. And what that is, it's like a 20 or 30 page digital PDF. Goes through everything from how to find good sponsors to work with, how to evaluate deals, how to evaluate markets, you know, terminology that can be complicated if you're just stepping into the space. You know, what are cap rates and what is NOI and how do you, you know, figure out the value of a multifamily property? All that kind of stuff's in there. You can find that at www.ashcroftcapital.com/passive investor. That'll also just send you a link to connect with me. Email is always the best way to start connecting with me. You can reach me at travis@ashcroftcapital.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, Facebook, BiggerPockets, all that kind of stuff. So feel free to reach out and talk to a lot of folks week to week about all kinds of stuff. It's not all multifamily. It's not all passive. It's just kind of where people are at and just trying to help in any way I can help. So please do reach out.
All right, cool. Well, hey, it is the end of the episode here. I really appreciate you taking the time during this unique, trying, challenging time for humanity to close the door, block out the distractions, and give us an hour of your time. Travis, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Dan. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Coming up next is Jason Perro on growing a 1,000-plus unit portfolio within a 20-minute driving radius. Many people struggle with the decision to stay local, growing and mastering a very small niche real estate market, or expanding the geographic circle further, sometimes across the country like I've done with Diamond Equity, or even around the world like Medical Properties Trust, of which I'm an investor. Jason brings us the local perspective on the upcoming show, and you will not want to miss it. Got a deal for sale? Need a buyer now? We've sold 41 houses year to date and currently have 97 more houses in our inventory. We are a large volume shop and we are still looking for more deals. Unlike many real estate investors who are currently corona restricted as a result of hard money lenders across the U.S. pushing pause on funding any more deals, we are well funded through private sources, personal resources, and long since been established lines of credit with multiple banks and are in big time buy mode. So if you have a deal, please either hit reply to my email or hit me up directly using the form at www.reidiamonds.com. I personally monitor both of those communication methods and pride myself on rapid responses. In other words, I'll make the decision quickly and get right back to you. And if you happen to be in the market for passive real estate investments, similar to those discussed in today's episode, in that they are completely hands-off and highly profitable, but different in the fact that these investments return capital in a much shorter time window, usually 6 to 12 months or less, head over to www.fundrehabdeals.com. This is where investors, passive investors, get the chance to passively participate in my deal flow here at Diamond Equity. We are at the end, my friend. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.